Today is Thursday, August 1st, 2002, and today's session is Contemporary Challenges Facing Parents and Children Today. It is presented by Marsha Bungie, and it is number BUM 2002-04. Let's listen in.
Generated a good discussion, I think, today about some of the challenges facing children and parents. I'm Marsha Bungie. I teach at Belfrays University. I teach theology and part of the Great Books program. And the series I'm doing this week is on the vocation of parenting. And I'm very interested in this issue, partly because we have two children of our own. I also teach at a church-related college, and we speak so much about, you know, helping form the whole person. And I speak to a lot of my college students about what's gone on in their family lives before coming to college. And it's just very interesting to hear some of their struggles and some of the things that went really well in their family life and some things that didn't go so well. And then I'm interested, as many of you are perhaps, in just concerns about children today, because so many children in our country and around the world face tremendous struggles. Poverty, lack of adequate education, depression, drug and alcohol abuse, and neglect. And so I've been very interested in issues regarding children the last 5 years. And last year we published a book that called The Child and Christian Thought. I edited this with a wonderful group of contributors. And we just tried to see.
I'm screwed out, sorry.
That's okay.
I can't stand it from the start.
Yeah, her stomach. And then lunch is rice. So anyway, we looked at how have we thought about children in Christianity? And some of the chapters are very sad chapters about how we've looked at them in a very narrow way and treated them in a very, we could say almost brutal ways. But there's also some very good chapters in this history of how we've thought about children and how we've treated children. So from that, I want to do now a more thematic book that looks at just what we've mined from this about parenting. What has our tradition said? Are there positive things in the tradition about parenting and how we treat children? Whether or not we have children of our own, you know, how do we treat children in our midst? So yesterday, Monday we looked at purposes and paradox of parenting. Tuesday, the nature of children, we started to talk about a more complex view of children that we find in the tradition, that they're gifts of God and sources of joy. Sinful creatures and moral agents, they have a developing sense of accountability. They're also developing beings in need of instruction. They're made in the image of God, and that means they're fully human, not just people on the way to becoming human, which we often kind of see children as sort of almost human. And there's quite a startling, disturbing quotes about how we've seen them almost like beasts on their way to becoming human. But the biblical text, they are fully human from the start, and that they're worthy of dignity and respect. There are also, we looked at, and I can give that handout to you too if you'd like, but there are also models of faith and really moral witnesses.
Oops, excuse me.
We're doing a little seminar style today.
I know another person
is here seeing people off.
Okay, all right.
They all wanted to see our.
Yeah, we had so many people leaving.
Yeah, we had to wave.
Okay. Hi. The one thing we looked at the Gospels is how children are treated even as models of faith, as kind of moral witnesses. They witness our actions and even vehicles of revelation. And that's a kind of a very interesting theme we find in the biblical text that isn't so emphasized in the tradition, but that is important, that we do learn things from children, that they are revelations to us, and that that's important to keep in mind as well. And that we looked at them, too, as the theme of children are orphans, neighbors, strangers. We need to treat them with compassion and with justice and help all the children in our midst. So then we looked at some practices yesterday, some spiritual attitudes, practices, and responsibilities of parenting. And, you can have that handout too if you'd like. But today I kind of wanted to focus primarily then on the challenges that are facing children and parents today. So I want to devote our discussion to that theme. I'd like to emphasize that although we all recognize the importance of good parenting, not only for children, but for our society as a whole, parenting really is not receiving the attention or respect it deserves, either in our culture or in our religious communities. For many reasons, the importance of parenting has been neglected and even undermined, and parents are not finding the spiritual resources or the kind of practical support they need to carry out their task with integrity. Neither religious communities nor the broader culture are providing a kind of sustained reflection on parenting or having a kind of rich language to articulate the sacred task we have as parents. Whether secular or religious, our language about parenting fails to capture the complexity and richness of this task and the value of parenting, not only for the children, but for society as a whole. So parents are kind of left knowing that their job is important, but they don't have that kind of rich language to articulate the depth of their experience or how parenting is tied to the common good, helping contribute to the common good, or even how it's tied to their own deepest moral religious beliefs. And furthermore, I don't think parents are receiving the kind of concrete support they need. They're not finding the broad-based support they need for what they're trying to accomplish. So as a result, millions of children are suffering and failing to thrive. And I'll just give you a few statistics that I always find disturbing. Approximately 16% of children in this country live in poverty. That's down from about 20%, but it's still about 1 in 6. This is the highest percentage of children living in poverty in any industrialized nation. Compare that rate, like to 4% in Germany. Or in Japan, it's just 2% of children live in poverty. Another statistic, teenage suicide rates doubled since the 1970s, and rates of teenage depression are rising. I see that even among my very brilliant, I work with honor students, and many of them, really struggle with depression, come to college with medication, and that's very positive. They're having, trying to address the problem, but I guess I've always been surprised, even though I've taught about 15 years in undergraduate settings, and the number of students coming in, even in my own little experience, is with depression is rising. Although rates of teenage pregnancy have dropped over the last 4 years, and that's very positive, still 1 in 8 children in the United States, 1 in 8 is born to a teenager. And an average of 9 children a day in the United States are killed by guns in their homes, neighborhoods, or schools. So that's just a tremendous 9 per day, approximately, killed in their homes, neighborhoods, or schools. And again, compare that to a place like Germany or Japan that have much stricter gun laws. The Children's Defense Fund talks about how our rate of children being killed by gunfire is more than 25 industrialized nations combined per year. So another disturbing fact is that 1 out of 8 teenagers never graduate from high school. As one commission claimed, never before has one generation of American children been less healthy, less cared for, or less prepared for life. Now, a lot of people would say, children are better off in many ways, and I think that's true. But even if we said, we don't want to talk about the decline, decline of child well-being in this country, we still have to admit these are disturbing facts about what children are experiencing in this country, and there are also disturbing statistics in other countries about how children are being treated. So whether or not we say it's better or worse, it's still not a good situation, and I think we need to address it. And one of the ways to do that, certainly, and we're going to talk about a wide range of things, but is to support parents in their task of parenting. That they are the primary moral and spiritual agents of their children. They need to nurture them. And we can do much more as individuals, as a church, as a country, to help support parents in their task. So I want to just look at some of the obstacles facing parents, both in our culture and in the church. Some of the ways parenting is being undermined and thereby affecting children in negative ways. And then we'll open up the discussion. I have a little handout here. But just to talk about some of the challenges you see that I don't mention, I'd like to hear some of the challenges and obstacles you see to parenting, and then ways to help address these challenges, ways to support children and families in our midst, whether or not we have children of our own. So I'll just give you this little handout. We can follow along. I'm going to kind of just go over some of these points, and then we'll have time for discussion. So my emphasis here again is that even though we recognize the importance of good parenting, support for parents is undermined in a number of ways in culture and in the church. So first of all, this first bullet. Many parents face serious economic pressures in the market-driven economy. So some have very good paying jobs, but they also have tight or inflexible schedules that don't allow parents to spend enough time with their children. There's a lot of wonderful books about the time bind that parents have. Due to demanding schedules, they really don't have enough time to spend with their children. And it's a complicated thing for women, I think, in particular, if they do have a good career. Even if they want to get off, sometimes they cannot get off some kind of leave. And if they do, this RAND Corporation recently did a study that showed even if you take off 2 to 4 years, as a break in employment, you lower your lifetime income by about 13%. And that rises to 19% for 5 years. So we're struggling with how we take the time to be with children even when we have good jobs. So many children are increasingly left at home alone to fend for themselves, even though our common sense tells us, and many wonderful studies, such as the one by the Harvard School of Public Health, tell us that the presence of parents in the home, after school, at dinner, at night, does so much to help children thrive academically, emotionally, socially, and reduces the incidence of risky behavior. So that's the time bind for many parents. Other parents have jobs, but are among the working poor. And so they have not only the time bind, but the money bind, and they don't even have enough money to pay for the basic needs of their children or to find adequate child care. As stated before, 16% of children live in poverty, and despite this CHIP program, which is a good program, a federal program working with states to help children get health care and health insurance, the CHIP, yeah. And I have a kind of website for that. But it's good. A lot of more children are getting health care in this country. But nevertheless, 9 million children are still without health care, and 90% of those children have working parents. Mm-hmm. So that's a very sad statistic for these parents working so hard but can't even afford the health insurance to provide medical care for their children. Now to this third point. In our consumer culture, professional careers tend to take priority over all commitments. And this kind of consumer mentality does influence our actions and behavior towards children. I do a lot of work in 18th century, kind of thought 17th century. I just did this article on a guy named Franke. There's always been this struggle with consumerism, a kind of affluence, this, you know, eagerness for affluence that you find in the 4th century with a guy like John Chrysostom, who was speaking to his group and saying, you know, you got to watch out that you're just so into consuming and buying more goods. And Franke in the 17th century saying the same thing. But a lot of people say that, so we struggle with materialism and over-concern about buying and consuming goods, but they say there's something extreme about what's going on in the United States today. I like the work of this Juliet Knorr. I put down her task, her name here. She wrote The Overworked American and The Overspent American. Those four sort of insight bullets, I'll just look at a second. She claims she's done a lot of work on in this area. She says, we live in what may be the most consumer-oriented society in history. Americans spend 3 to 4 times as many hours a year shopping as their counterparts in Western European countries. We look increasingly to consumption to give us satisfaction, even meaning to our lives, even though increasing consumption has not made us happier. Materialism has not only failed to make us happy, it also has bred its own form of discontent, even among the affluent. There was a very interesting article in the New York Times a few years ago when they were getting these dot-com things going, and how so many young people felt terrible if they only had that six-figure income. They felt they were failures and were not really able to buy what they needed to buy when they saw their friends you know, making much more than they did. So that what you think of as, boy, you know, we're on the border here with our six-figure income is really getting out of whack. She says, she makes this point too, that more and more we're able to buy goods without money, helping to foster a climate of instant gratification, expanding expectations, and materialism. And that success in business depends on nurturing these kind of qualities like wastefulness, self-indulgence, and artificial obsolescence. One thing I found very interesting in talking to pastors and in very middle-class, upper-middle-class congregations is you say, well, why don't some of these parents cut down on their work or, you know, quit their job? They have one person earning a tremendous income. Couldn't they, you know, arrange something a little better for their kids? But you know what's getting them out? It's not the mortgage. It's not the car payment. It's not, you know, the basic needs. It's the credit card debt that they cannot, and it's a kind of a silent shame that they cannot quit their job because they have tremendous credit card debt.
Well, I think it's also devaluing the person that stays home with the children here, children raise them.
Yes.
It's like you don't do anything.
Right. We have that. We don't honor that kind of work. We don't honor that time spent with children.
Yeah.
But I find even among my college students, a lot of them, they are really spending a lot with credit cards. You know, they get these announcements in their boxes that says sort of, you want to be a responsible person, you want a nice credit record, you get this credit card. Well, many of them get out of college with $8,000, $10,000 credit card bills already, and how they get out of that when they start, they're already anxious before they begin a career. So that was interesting to me, that this consumption has played a role in then how you can take back off even from your job, even when it is flexible. So anyway, I found that very interesting. The next point that several scholars certainly have emphasized, that we live in a culture that highly values individualism and self-fulfillment. I think a lot of you have read some of these texts like Bowling the Bowl or some of these others by Bella Putnam that have emphasized that we have a kind of emphasis on individualism and self-fulfillment that undermines not only parental responsibilities but our civic responsibilities. So these scholars claim that an overemphasis of individualism is eroding our obligation to others, including children. So this individualistic ethos, which blossomed in the 60s and fostered by the baby boom generation, highly values personal freedom and self-fulfillment. And so within this context, you know, self-fulfillment, personal growth, start becoming the criteria from which you judge what you're going to be doing or what kind of obligations you have. And so that undermines personal responsibility not only for one's own children, but a shared commitment to the children in our midst. The next point, in addition, the media and popular culture bombard us with images of parents as unimportant, inept, or neglectful. And I like this. I like many things about this book, not everything about this book, but Cornel West and Sylvia Ann Hewlett wrote a book together called The War Against Parents, and they have a wonderful chapter in there that just goes on and on about the demeaning images that you find in television, in movies, in kind of songs, popular songs for young people about parents. And that's a very interesting chapter in there. One article in the Washington Post was called Father Knows Squat, in contrast to Father Knows Best, and pointing out that in the media, parents are one of the few remaining groups that are regularly ridiculed, caricatured, or marginalized.
Do you want to wait to make
it? No, go ahead. I think
I can appreciate what you say there, and that there is a demeaning of parents. At the same time, I think the kind of father knows best thing romanticized
yes.
parents.
Right.
And that in itself served to silence a lot of children about what was happening to them in the homes.
Yes.
Because homes, we can talk, and in the best possible circumstances, are havens. But a lot of homes are not havens.
Right.
And that somehow children need permission to see mm-hmm. that parents who may even look really good to the community are really being very destructive, and people spend half their lives trying to understand the turmoil inside
mm-hmm.
because the culture supports a romanticization of the parents didn't know best, and they didn't, you know, they themselves don't. And so that's a kind of a tension, isn't it?
It is a tension. There's a nice book I put on this list. This, I have a kind of general bibliography, but called The Way We Never Were. The Way We Never Were about families.
Right.
Looking in the 50s, exactly what you're saying about how so much of abuse was silenced, or very we would say very abusive treatment of children, racism, kind of was silenced during this time too, romanticizing this picture. So I think that's right, you don't want to romanticize it, but at the same time, we want to find some enduring qualities and some positive qualities about your family, about parents. So being open, I think, to that tension is really important. The next point about violent and crude television programs that children are watching. I put down the statistic that children watch approximately 27 hours of TV a week. That is a very, I know, a kind of emphasized by many studies, that that's almost like a part-time job, isn't it? I mean, 27, I kind of wonder, how could that really happen? But if you think, some kids get up, eat their breakfast with the TV show, they come home from school, they watch a couple hours, so you add, you know, 2 times 7, that's already 14, and you watch something at night. But that's a tremendous amount, and even if people said, oh, it's not so harmful to their intellectual, emotional development, it's not so bad, I watched TV when I was young. But you think about the wasted time that you could have had for occasions to talk to adults. That is a disturbing statistic, too. And then in addition to these kinds of obstacles, parents don't receive the kind of governmental support and economic benefits that they do in some other industrialized countries. Many sociologists are beginning on this theme of families now and have tremendously powerful and good studies, like Popano, I put him on this bibliography too, or Amato, another guy named Amato, who done wonderful work on what's going on with families. And they talk about that parents don't receive the kind of tax breaks that they used to, even in this country in the 50s, that if you equated the kind of tax break they had in the 50s to now, it'd be, in our dollars today, about $6,500 of a tax break you get per child. That we don't have that anymore, but or the kind of leave policies. I lived many years in Germany for 5 years, and boy, it's just another world. It's another world. Or we have roots in Norway, and so we know a lot.
Yeah, I heard about that in Sweden too. And it was after I had my first. I was in Sweden before I had my first child, and found out not only was there leave for the mothers, there was leave for the fathers. And it was like something for the mothers, like at least 2 years, and for the fathers it was 18 months. And I was trying to get 2 months off, and that was before they passed, the president passed the law, the Family Leave Act. And I was just really for that because I couldn't get off 2 months. Or I'd lose my job.
Right.
And I was just, I should have quit. I was pretty angry.
We have family leave. And the women have
Australia.
The women can take up to 5 years parenting leave and come back to the job, or they can come back part time. And each year, they have to declare what they want for the next year, and they can still come back to their jobs. The fathers can take time off too. So sometimes, like, the mother will take the first year, and then the father will take the second year.
So
our neighbors have just done that, and then they've gone to part-time work, or some of the work they can actually take home and do some of the work from home and some of the work in home. And now the big push is to paid maternal leave for at least 6 months after the birth of the child. And so that's sort of being fought because, you know, that's quite contentious, because they say it may be a backlash against women. But it is parenting we have.
So how then, if a person takes 5 years off, what does the company do?
Oh, they put somebody else into that
position. With the idea that they can't, that when the other person comes back, they will have to.
Yeah, but then there's lots of movement anyway in work. And people will come in, or they'll find all sorts of ways of managing that break. And if somebody looks like they have been sacked because somebody found out they're pregnant and will want this leave, then there's a tribunal and they can get recompense for that. So it's illegal to sack someone because she's there. Even casual employees, it's now coming on that if I was in a board, an executive that had a woman who was on a fixed contract, and we had decided her work wasn't satisfactory, so that we weren't going to renew the contract. But she happened to let somebody know she was pregnant in the meantime, and they didn't tell the executive. And so then we had to pay her compensation of several thousand dollars.
Wow. Well, it's interesting, you know, in a discussion here, people, even the parental leave act was like, this is insane, you can't do it. It's not, there's no pay even, it's just,
yeah,
not
just time off.
And yet you look at these other countries that have, you know, in Sweden, you are paid.
That's what I thought. I was.
You get some kind of, I think it's full pay for a while, and then it goes down to 75%. But these other countries seem to recognize that, gee, it's good for society, it's good for the kids if you have someone.
A little backwards when it comes to families.
Yes, it does.
And sick leave, that parents have certain number of days they can take, not out of their own paid sick leave,
but for their children,
but because of their children.
Yeah, yeah, see, so I usually always use up my sick leave on my children.
That's what they found. 10 days, and it's
so 22
kids.
There's an equivalent amount for your children.
Yeah.
For children who are sick. Or parents. The other thing now is elderly parents.
That's good for Australia.
Sweden.
But we're not as economically developed or anything, you know, but some of us resist.
Maybe that's not their drive. It's for commercialism or this here.
Yeah.
Always be better and bigger and better.
Oh, there are advantages in each country.
Well, maybe let's just look briefly at the second part on the church, and then we can come back to some other things. I did want to mention the very end. There's some very interesting work by some psychologists, too, who say even the marriage counselors, you know, are supposed to be sort of helping families, have a really tough time helping families. That this guy, Doherty, in Minnesota, and Pfeiffer, a woman who wrote that, Reviving Ophelia, it was very popular, she's written a book now on families. They kind of say this popular culture and some counseling tends to also undermine families and obligations to families. It's just kind of, how do you feel? You need your happiness. You need to be self-fulfilled. What do you need to do for your journey? But there's no language, even the dimension of, maybe you have a moral responsibility to your children. What are you going to do with that? It's a little more complex, isn't it, than your personal happiness. And they have written some wonderful things. I put their resources there too, Doherty, especially, also Bella, but also then this Pfeiffer, on how even their own profession is a kind of critique of their own profession of not having a richer kind of discussion about parenting and marriage, even within marriage counseling. They found, the story found that 70% of marriage counselors either have a negative or a neutral view about marriage. That a lot of people go there saying, can you help us with our marriage? It's like, well, I'm sorry, I give it up. why work at it? I went to a wonderful conference at Princeton where they just went on and on with these statistics from sociologists and psychologists kind of critiquing their own profession.
Can I also interrupt?
Yeah.
Is that all right?
No, I love it.
One of the things that happened when I was in India is it was a real insight for me. I lived there for 4 years, and there was this term adjust that I noticed every time I was talking with people. They talked about within families this need for adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they largely have arranged marriages. And you probably have an understanding of that too. That the goal isn't, because it isn't about individuals, it's about the family and the community. And I always thought, we're on about families. You know, I remember, you know, when our family, didn't matter how bad it was, you were in this family. But it's in the whole culture is that you must adjust. And this is your first responsibility, is to find ways to adjust. And then did get to points where adjustment just couldn't make the gap. You know, something's beyond it. But by and large, we all have to adjust. Children have to adjust. Parents have to adjust. mm-hmm. had to adjust because they're arranged. They had to mm-hmm. learn to adjust to different families.
Well, to see how that language you're saying is kind of widespread. And for us, it's more that language isn't so widespread. There's also a wonderful one at the University of Chicago, who's Linda Waite, who's writing a lot on parents and marriage. And she has this idea, too, that we don't do enough to say, wait a little while, adjust a little while in the marriage or with your children and see what happens. That things change as you go along the way. And they did this so interesting study that certainly divorce, in many cases, you're saying, is a positive move for the children in high conflict marriages or abusive families, but that of the ones who kind of stuck with it, and they were unhappy but not high conflict, not abusive, very unhappy, 86% of those marriages after 5 years are either happy or very happy. And how do you stick with it? It's usually if family members kind of encourage you or friends kind of encourage you. So you need that support of other people saying, well, you know, that happened to me, it was rotten. Yeah, we, you know, kind of slug through it. And that works for some families. Well, let's just look real quickly at a couple things on the church. I mainly want to focus about, you know, certainly the church upholds the importance of parenting. We're on sort of side two there.
Thank you.
And offers a variety of programs for families and children. But there are elements, too, in the church, I think, that undermine the importance of parenting. I like the work of, this is the second point, Todd Whitmore of Notre Dame. He talks about how the church doesn't really have a strong teaching about parenting and children. The church basically says parents are to teach their children the faith, and children should obey their parents. Those are the strong things, instruct them in the faith, have them obey. But beyond this, little is said about the nature of children, the nature of children's spirituality, or about the obligations and duties of parents. And you know, he talks about how most churches have far more elaborate teachings about other issues, albeit related to family issues, like abortion or contraception, moral conduct in war or homosexuality. There's a lot of debates, statements, teachings written about them, but not so much about parenting. Once you have a child in your midst, what do we think about that? What do we think about your obligation? So much sort of like pre-kid abortion, contraception. You know? But then you get the kid, it's kind of up to you, and there isn't that kind of guidance that we find for other issues. I'll just mention a couple things. Like the Catholic Church certainly upholds the importance of parenting. And they do have excellent programs for families. But it doesn't have that kind of extended moral teaching. There's a lot more teaching there about not so much parenting, but the celibate life. And then these other issues like birth control or abortion. Mainline Protestant churches have paid even less attention to a kind of ethic of the family or parenting. In part, they kind of allowed the religious right to take over this theme. And that's why they haven't touched it. Don Browning, who's trying so hard at the University of Chicago to talk about families in mainline churches, as soon as he says family, it's like people shove him into, oh yeah, I know what you're going to say. You are going to be so patriarchal and so, you know, a damning of women. And he hasn't even opened his mouth, you know, but because he's talking about family values, it was already usurped, in a way, by the conservative right.
New words.
We do. And so they haven't really then brought up this as a positive issue. They have a lot of wonderful, mainline churches have very good daycare programs. They have a lot of good things about helping children in poverty, helping fight against gun laws, you know, to support gun laws, excuse me. But they don't have that kind of strong teaching. And the Protestant, evangelical, conservative churches have addressed issues of parenting. That's in part why they're growing. They recognize the needs of families, and they have tremendous programs for parents, for single parents, for people going through divorce. They offer all these tremendous programs, but some of their literature is very narrow about children. It focuses so much on, you know, discipline or punishment, but not so much on the whole picture, as we were talking about the other day, of who are children and even learning something from children. So there's not that rich kind of teaching that I wish we had. Some people are starting to write about this, and I have some resources there, and I welcome those things. But more needs to be done, I think, in that way. I think I just would like to go over them just very quickly. I think I almost just read the third through the seventh point, that recent studies show that most parents in the church mistakenly believe they're not the primarily responsibility, that they're not primarily responsible for the faith formation of their children, but that the church is kind of responsible. And that's a problem in the church, because then parents don't take up this role as strongly. And the Strumman, you know, the Search Institute and in Minneapolis and the Youth and Family Institute, they emphasize this so much, the wonderful resources I have on that bibliography too, where they say parents need to be the primary moral, spiritual teachers, and the church needs to help guide them, but we can't just say, you drop them off, we're going to do the spiritual education, religious education, and then nothing at home. Because if you think about that, even if you have the best curriculum in the world, and if you look at some of the curriculum for religious ed, it's not so great. You know? So even if you had said, wow, we fixed it, we got the best in the world, you've got 1 hour of Sunday school, and then you compare that to 27 hours of TV a week. So if there isn't resonance in the home, if there isn't some kind of appropriation, some kind of emphasis that you find in the church, then it's not going to really influence children much at all anyway. So people are trying to say more, well, how do we work together with parents in the church to help facilitate what should be going on in the home? And I think that's positive, but not enough has been done that way. And so churches tend to operate, this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, in isolation from the home, not as an extension of the home. And many parents within the church are neglecting to speak with children about moral and spiritual matters and neglecting to integrate practices into their everyday lives, so that they can nurture faith in the home. I have a couple statistics here, these sort of inserted bullets there. According to one study of 8,000 adolescents whose parents were members of congregations in 11 different Protestant and Catholic denominations, only 10% of these families discuss faith with any degree of regularity, and 43% of the families, they never discuss faith issues in the home. That's really startling, isn't it? And 8,000, that's not a small study. Also, in another study of 6 major Protestant denominations, 35% of youth between 16 and 18 said they rarely, if ever, talked about faith or God with their mother. And 56% reported not ever having such discussions with their father. I have that book mentioned here, too, where he cites that study by Merton and Pardell in Passing on the Faith. I just want to say, I can confirm this in my work with college students, that I'm so shocked that many of them say they're committed Christians. And
we have to go do dishes.
Oh, good luck. You'll be there in a couple hours.
Oh, yeah. I think they were stacked up, I'm afraid.
But, you know, it's so sad with my college students even. They say, we've been going to Sunday school for years. They're committed Christians. 90% of my students are. Would say, I am a Christian. But very few of them say they've talked about issues of faith with their parents, and or, you know, sexuality or anything, or in their church. And I'm always so shocked, and so I started doing a little questionnaire, kind of saying, who have you talked to about faith issues? And a lot of them say they have never talked about it in the home. They go to church with their parents, but then it's kind of, that's the end of it. They don't have prayers together or any kind of discussion. So I was really surprised by that. So they see faith as very private. I guess so private you don't even talk about it with your family. And so then how do you think they're kind of appropriate or find, you know, how you connect faith and life if you're not talking about that with your family? So I that's always surprised me.
I think but you still, sorry, go ahead.
It's still 35% say they rarely talk. That means that 65% are
yes.
talking. So that's
yes,
kind of,
right.
Yeah, you know, at least there's
right.
Yeah.
I've talked, with
and
your
half
mother.
Of them, half of them are talking, or almost half of them are talking.
And that's positive. And today I'm being a little bit negative. I'm throwing out the problem so tomorrow we can be positive and say what can we do and what are some success stories. But that's right. I mean, there's some people talking, but even Bob, you know, guys know Bob Benny, this ethicist at Roanoke College, he's been quite a bit, and he wrote a very open piece in this journal, The Present, about what I would have done differently with my children. And he said he thought that just by living his faith and being an example, his children would kind of pick up why faith is important to him. But what he regrets he did not do was talk to them, to just talk to them about some of these issues. And they didn't do that. They said in prayer, but they never really talked about faith issues. So anyway, he regrets that, because none of his children, and that's certainly not a sign of faith maturation all the time, but none of them really have anything to do with the church anymore. And don't know why that faith is so important to the father, even though it's written, you know, tons of books. So when they had that Littleton thing, you know, so many young people said they wished they could talk more to adults. And it's hard to talk to teenagers sometimes. But 75% of them, they did this sort of study, wish they had more conversation with adults. Maybe we could talk today about how you facilitate that, how that happens.
They wanted to talk about what happened at Littleton or about anything?
Just
be able to talk to adults?
Caring conversation with adults. Did I have that statistic here? I could almost never believe it, that how many minutes are spent talking alone to your mom and dad. I have it in here somewhere, but it's something like 20 minutes a week a child spends alone talking to the mother. That's something.
It's real hard to get a conversation going mm-hmm. with a teenage yeah. boy.
Right.
They need to be able to grunt. But we find, actually, even Anjali said, have you noticed how much we talk in the car?
Yes.
There's something yeah. about driving in the car. Mm-hmm. Nothing else can get at you. There's no telephone.
Yes.
And the deep conversations
yes.
Are really important. But I wanted to also go back to the person you're saying wishing they had talked to their children more.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, I'm sort of thinking I was going to be a perfect parent third time around. Because I had 14 years to reflect on the first two attempts. But what always struck me when my sons, who are the older ones, were 13 or 14, values and things they expressed that I could never remember telling them, but they were my values.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things I've always been impressed by is the fact that some of the things that are really important to me, they're thinking and I can't remember telling them.
Mm-hmm.
And also that they have formulated their own opinions and have developed also opinions different to mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think conversation is important, but I think conversation is a state of keeping the relationship going,
yes.
and valuing your relationship. But I somehow often feel they are living in a whole other context. They're growing up in a different context to ours. And the most important thing is I can do is have faith that they will develop their own opinions that are grounded in very good rationales for them.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I talk it through or might suggest where they might go to think about a rationale. But I've increasingly lost my sense that I'm in control of what they will
yes,
think,
right.
but that I'm an enabler of them finding a way to think about something.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I would, if I were to talk to that person, I would say to them, don't feel sad you didn't tell them why, because I think they would have, I would credit them with the intelligence to have figured that out.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something in contemporary mm-hmm. society in which those children live that this isn't answering
mm-hmm.
their sense of importance and need,
mm-hmm.
and it's their context.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they still have a lot of growing and changing and thinking to
yes.
do. And as they get older, you move to be more like your parents.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're saying it's like conversation is important, but just the living it out, and then they have to work it out in what context.
Your own integrity
yes.
about
how
what you believe and how
to...
you act and how you talk with your friends. They hear you talking with your friends.
Yes.
And it always surprises me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, still, I don't know why it still surprises me. I've been parenting for over 30 years, but it surprises me what comes out of my children's mouths and my children's friends' mouths in the way that they have thought really deeply.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I agree with you. To think about children as not quite human, that
mm-hmm.
always upsets me.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a lot to hear in children.
Yeah.
And people change. Like marriage relationships change, parent-child relationships change over time. Mm-hmm. I have to keep reminding my mother I've grown up.
Well, you know, you mentioned, maybe we could just, you had other occasions, like you talk about the example, but the car is a place. What were the things that facilitated, you know, or at least where children, if it's not a direct conversation, are overhearing what you're thinking? I think that's important, too. I mean, what things have you found? What kinds of occasions have been positive, or how did that happen? Like you were asking, you know, how does that happen with adolescents?
Lots of times if an event happens in the news.
Oh, yeah.
Or even in just a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was one TV show about a young girl that was 14, my son's 16, and she was doing ecstasy. And ecstasy.
Yeah. The drug.
Yeah.
Just to open up.
And she was only 14. But we were able to. My son and I were able to talk. Maybe she was in the car. We do a lot of that in the car because it just seems to.
Yeah.
Like you say.
It's the big thing too, because you're looking forward.
Yes.
We don't
can
have
actually
to sit here and
make very intimate conversations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that event in the TV mm-hmm. show made it possible to have a pretty good conversation, and I got some insights into how he thinks about drugs and alcohol. And so since then, we've had like. One time we were talking about alcohol in the car, and he says, "Alcohol, I'm not going to drink alcohol. This is what gets you dead."
Mm-hmm.
I said, what? He was referring to
Mark.
A friend of ours whose son died from, it had related to alcohol.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he had drunk too much, and passing out outside, and it was cold. And hypothermia, was in the end what, and his friends found him out there, but and got him to the hospital. He was still alive, but he didn't live the night.
He's on machines and stuff. Mm-hmm. But he had mixed alcohol and a pain cocktail that he found in his friend's refrigerator or something. So it's kind of complicated. But anyway, my son, who at that time, he's probably 5 or 7 years younger than Mark, but he and Mark had a pretty good connection. They just, you know,
mm-hmm.
I don't know,
clicked. From camping.
And, you know, they just, I don't know, Adam really liked Mark, so that was really hard for me.
Mm-hmm.
But see, that was 5 years ago,
yes.
I think. And so, but my son is still remembering that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it took me a while when he said, "I'm not going to get alcohol, it'll get you dead."
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know that's not good English, but that's the way he said it, it gets you dead.
Mm-hmm. What you're saying about, you know, these events that help facilitate conversation, or that car thing, I get so sad about the videos now they have in the car.
What?
My biggest time for conversation is in the vehicle because we commute a lot.
Yeah.
And I make it a point to turn off the radio, but then I know I'm divorced and with their father it's a whole different thing. They have the videos, they have the headphones,
mm-hmm.
you can plug in stereo or television,
mm-hmm.
and they don't have that conversation going on, and so you miss out on a lot and don't know what's going on in your lives.
You know, the best time to is when you've got other kids in the car.
Yes.
And you're driving
your
head
top
of
back here.
They forget you're there.
They act like they're just in their own little world. And that's good.
And I think also, we have two television programs that we have to choose the programs. And there's one Anjali really likes to watch, but it's set in the hospital. It's not all dramatic like ER, it's an Australian one, and it deals with social issues. And the next night is one about a country police station that Norman really likes. And so that's their relationship. Norman always watches hers with her. And she always watches the police one with Norman. It deals with a lot of social issues, like Indigenous issues and other things, but it's in a sort of an ongoing story and characters. And if he's away, she always takes them. She'll watch hers. Then she will save his and not watch it. But they will then watch the two
Isn't
of them.
That nice?
And so that's a chance for them to talk
mm-hmm.
as well. I mean, they do watch TV,
mm-hmm.
but you've got to be here. It's almost like this loyalty. If you arrange to not sit down. And I can't get into it, but I've actually decided I'll back out because that's their chance for their relationship. And she and I like watching a trite thing like Better Homes and Gardens and cooking stuff, but then we'll cook the stuff together. But then we'll talk, and as we cook, talk. So we have the TV, but we haven't, we try not to, but there are a few things she wants to watch, and I just say, I cannot watch that movie because I do not like it. What's in there. And so eventually she ends up not watching it anymore. But I don't tell her she can't watch it. I say, this is not something that you have to make your own mind up. This is something I can't
and
watch.
How old is she?
She's 16 and a half.
But you know, they like that when you sit down with them. And we talked about that kind of on Monday and Wednesday, about these rituals that help. And that's a ritual. They don't say, hey, let's sit down and have a meaningful conversation about social issues. But you know, during the commercial, you'll say something like, you start talking. So it's set up, it's already negotiated. You don't have to say, come on, honey, let's sit down. It's just a ritual.
Yeah.
And that's nice. These kind of rituals open it up to conversation. What do you find, or what are some of your concerns about children, Todd?
Well, I'm not a parent. I've just completed my first year in parish ministry as a director of youth and family ministry at the church.
Wow.
One of the things I think that has surprised me is I think I've always carried the attitude that perhaps many adults carry that in order to have really an authentic conversation with a youth, it has to sort of happen spontaneously, because otherwise they'll think, you know, well, this is fake. And I've always had that attitude. What has surprised me is that as I have developed a relationship of trust with kids, which I think most parents perhaps have a relationship of trust with their kids, that I can be intentional, that we can do something at a scheduled time, and they will respond. I mean, there is an awkward period at the beginning of, oh, we're going to do this thing because we have to now and you want to talk about whatever. But once we find a place where what I'm trying to get at clicks in their minds and they can relate it to their lives, then our conversation is just as authentic. And it really, I find we get a lot more accomplished by being intentional about having times for that than me, you know, because I'm not in the home all the time with them, and it's not my job anyhow. Just waiting for that spontaneous moment where they have something they're going to want to talk about with me on a deep level.
Right.
I wonder how many opportunities for deep conversation are sacrificed because we're waiting for the youth to initiate.
So are you working with teens? Teenagers?
Middle school and high
school
primarily.
Well, I'm glad you said that because I was just thinking, I wonder if I set a certain time every day for Adam and I just to, I mean, just, that was our time together. And then I immediately thought, oh, that'd never work because he would just probably sit there and go, okay. But now that you said that, I think, well, maybe I could try it anyway.
But don't tell them.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Form a ritual. Find something that they like to do and that you could participate in with them, and then that conversation will come about. Because that's what I found with my children, just like you were saying with the television shows. There's certain instances that we do that's very ritual, and the children will even ask you if you get off track, are we going to do this? And they very much like those ritual things. So if you just find some kind of
ritual. Okay.
Yeah.
And that's what you said. It's something they like to do already. You know, you're not saying, now we're going to sit down.
Like she was saying, something she could do was cooking and gardening. You have to find something that they have an interest in that you also could get involved with.
But I also think it's right for you to say, you're going to like this time. Because if we only do things that they want to do, they think they're the only people with rights. They actually need to learn that we have feelings and rights. And so that if you feel like you'd really like to be able to have a conversation, it's good, you know, to say you know, I'm missing you. I really want to have a conversation with you. And they mightn't come to it that time, but sometimes I think they incubate the idea. Mm-hmm. And then they come to it in their own way.
Yeah,
but they know that you have feelings and rights. And I think one of the biggest mistakes I've made over time is to keep saying, I've had plenty of life, I can do this a bit later, and I can, and to actually do myself out of time and rights, and so they don't get to see that you actually do want their company.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they ought to be with you, but you actually like them enough to want their company.
Yeah. And it's meaningful to you.
Yes.
Like, so many, sometimes people talk about, you know, they work too much, and it's so sad for the children, but it's also sad for the parents that they're missing out on the time, and that's a meaningful thing for you. But to try to build it in, I think that's important, yeah.
You see, it's the moment. I even found it out with, I kept trying to get my kids to help me go out and garden, go out and weed. Oh, that's less than I want to do.
I agree.
Well, I know, but I had to do it. It had to be done, and so I couldn't spend time with them. But sometimes, well, one, she wanted something, and I said, you know what, I think weeding would be a great way to earn that, instead of me just giving her money for her Girl Scout books. So she went out there and weed, but I didn't just send her out there. I went out there and I did it with her, side by side. Well, pretty soon my youngest one, she thought, what's up with this? She wanted to get in on it. So she's out there and I taught her how to weed with this weeding tool. And she goes, oh, this is kind of fun. I like doing this. So now I get her going out there with me to weed for nothing.
No.
And it gives us time to spend together. And that's the other thing, is like, I figure, you know, it's something I gotta get done, and I could just, you know, bribe them, like my oldest one, and let them go do it on their own, but it's a good time to go spend some time together doing the chore. But when I asked them to do it, neither one of them would.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mine are 4 and 6, so the best time is like bedtime, because then they don't want to talk because they get to stay up later. So that's the most verbal. But we found this year a couple things happened that we had to kind of take the opportunity. You never know how much time you're going to have. I had a little bout with cancer earlier this year, so you know they're at a young age. But I felt it was really important to talk with them about that, teach them about that, so that you know, they learned a lot at a young age, and it, hopefully it won't be as scary for them. They're a lot very curable, which one was.
Yeah.
Things. I don't want them to grow up like I did, where this was a big, scary, awful thing.
Mm.
But then, it seems like it's, you know, almost over, but we had a cancer walk in our town a couple weeks ago, and I mean, I had to drag them. They put up a fuss, but once they got there, we just went to the little luminaria thing you buy, a luminaria, and put somebody's name on it or something. They bought one for me, and then we bought one for a friend of ours who has a much more invasive cancer. And so, you know, we put it out and we walked the loop together, and it was the best time. You know, it's kind of reinforcing what we've already talked about, but they, it was a real connecting time again. So
I think that nighttime thing you were saying too is so, it's just something about that eye contact too. Because they open up a little bit. That it's dark, you were reading, and then you turn the light out. And our son too just opens up so much. One of our friends, my aide, died this 2 years ago, and he didn't talk about it during the day. It was his mother, his best friend's mother. So, you know, and the best friend is his age, and then she was my age. And so we would always say, wait, you want to talk about it? But at night, we turn the light off, and then he would just talk and talk.
Yeah.
So that's a good point, too. That's interesting, isn't it, about the eye?
Sometimes
you don't want
it. And it's more of a feeling kind of thing in the dark or something. You know, it's just you can have the emotions there and be there without that straight into the face.
I think that's more true for men than women. I don't know if that's true. But that, and I think I was reading this in particularly in the context of marriage, that if you wanted to talk to your spouse, go for a walk.
Oh, yeah.
So you didn't have to sit there and look at you.
Oh,
well, I say with that, or like boys, some studies say boys, you know, if you go play basketball, they'll open up, but they won't say sit down.
Yeah, because but girls, you know, and I say to you, if you go to lunch with a friend, a female friend, you can sit there and talk across the table, and it's very there is something kind of girly about it, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe
you're a token guy. Took you to lunch, then you're fine. You say we need to talk.
We should close this formally, but I do have a question. Everyone can answer this. You know, it's so interesting. You look at some of this, and you just wonder, people have all their theories. Why don't we treat parenting with more respect or honor, or children?
Because there's no formal
training. What's going on?
Yeah.
What's going on? I just love your ideas about
it. I have this kind of theory that I've used about teaching, because I teach people to teach in universities. And it's often treated as a natural activity. But if you know something, like if you're a lawyer or a doctor or whatever, you can teach it. And the problematic I'm trying to encourage is people to think, what is it like from the position of the learner? And I think you can take the same thing to parenting. It's treated as natural. We've all been parented, so therefore we can all parent. Mm-hmm. And it's assuming we've all had good models of parenting. And it's, but we need to treat it as a problematic and think, what is it going to be like for the child? And I think being a parent is, thinking as a parent is different from just being a mother or a father. It's actually thinking, how do you want this person to be? Mm-hmm. You know, and we often talk about children, what they want to be when they grow up. We don't say, what do you want to be like when you grow up? And we often think about children, what will they be when they grow up, rather than what they'll be like. And so if you want them to be like that, what does that mean I must do as a parent? And that's a problematic approach to it. So how do I work in this context? And there's no recipes or formulas, I don't think. Mm-hmm. A lot of it's trusting yourself and trusting your children. I mean, here I'm espousing, and you know, I've probably made three major blooms.
No, I agree, and I think that sometimes where the church is focused on thinking that everybody has good, intentional, caring, loving families comes from that, because I hear that oftentimes in sermons, and it hits me really hard, because it hurts me, because I know I didn't come from that, mm-hmm. and they weren't my role models. I had to look elsewhere, mm-hmm. and so I almost feel like they just have this assumption, mm-hmm. and so they don't really go out there to encourage good parenting and give you those skills. And
mm-hmm. or even just talk about
It. Just talking about
it. You know, we can talk about some issues, but not parenting.
Problems, it's
your private thing. It's your right as a parent to do what you want with your kids.
And some people want to do, don't want to share and keep it all private. Mm.
Somehow I feel like in society now it's a choice.
Yeah.
And somehow that ties in. You know, you choose to be parents, and if you don't, you know, you can.
Well, contraception has done that a lot.
Right, exactly.
You can choose to be. You do have a lot more choice now.
You choose to be childless, and you know, you can get a lot more done if you're childless.
Well, I was saying too about then it's less communal because it was your private choice.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
And maybe before, if it wasn't just, well,
and
we
people
say, we got it. It's a community.
Yeah, there's going to be marriage, there's going to be children,
and
that.
You got to help it out here.
Well, baby carriage follows.
Yeah, it's your fault. Mm-hmm. Or your choice.
So you're trying to, you know, lament with someone about the struggles or something, and they're like,
that's interesting.
But the stereotypes belong in the notion of the natural rather than a problematic approach. And who is a family? You know, we see some people as more families than not families. It's sort of like if there's two parents and a reasonable number of children, well, that's a family. But if it's just got one child or one parent or a parent plus somebody coming in who also chooses to help parent. I mean, a lot of people who haven't had children are very good parents to children.
Very
good parent.
Right.
To a lot of adolescents in your ministry.
Yes.
Yes. Here's the green.
Yes.
A mentor, you sort of need people.
You may be. You need people that are not your parent, that are adults. I'm thinking of the guy. I have one from yesterday, the day before yesterday. I want to ask you something, because you're talking about challenges, and there was one thing that I wanted to bring up that I haven't heard you mention, and that is the lack of availability of truly meaningful work for children. Now, I'm not talking child labor here, but there's we've gone so far towards the knowledge worker that it truly takes a university education to do anything meaningful. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And even the, I work in the computer field, and we used to have some dumb work available. Taking tape cartridges and sticking them in the machine. You know, but my oldest daughter, who's now 30, did that job for a couple summers. And it, you know, she worked swing shift, and it was dumb, stupid work, but it was work, and it paid reasonably well. And the entry points into work seem to come so much later now than into meaningful work. Yes, maybe you could go flip a burger, but that then you get into the whole food thing, and is that really meaningful work? And a, and so, and even when I look at my daughters and contrast that to me, and contrast that to my parents' generation, I can remember a story of a man who goes to our church. Stan Marshall told the story of when he was a young man, he's in his 70s now, in a small town, he worked at a bank. And the bank was small, and he was on occasion, after he worked there a couple of summers, left in charge of the bank for a day. And that meant that one time he told the story of having to decide whether to make a loan. He was a 19-year-old young man, and the bank president or whoever was out of town for the day. He was in charge of the bank. The money was needed today, and he had to decide. Mm-hmm. He decided to make the loan. That it all turned out okay, but the point I'm trying to make is the amount of real responsibility, and that was kind of a very growing experience for him. He went into the financial field, was very successful with it, but had that opportunity to do something real at quite a young age that we don't seem to have.
I think the opportunities are there. It's just no one's going to pay for them. I remember being at the end of the 70s at a conference called the Work Ethic Under Challenge, and all these suited people got up for the first 4 days, and they expounded on education for leisure, education for unemployment, all this kind of stuff. End of the 70s, when there was a real, you know, employment crisis, which hadn't changed. But then at the very end, this little woman, Eva Cox, stood up, and she just had black trousers, black shirt. She hadn't decorated herself. She's still a really profound commentator. And she just walked up to the microphone, the very last keynote speaker, finally a woman. She said, "I don't know why you're talking about this. There's a lot of work to be done. There's elderly people to be cared for. There's parks to be cared for. There's young children to be cared for. There's homeless youth to be cared for. There's all these things." She said, "No one will pay for it.
No one will pay for it."
But
my daughter's doing some of that this summer. She's worked as a volunteer at an animal hospital, which is something, and just in their office for. But still, yes, that's important. But I think that that's a societal issue. Society should pay for that kind of work.
But even if they don't, I think it can be done. Like the way Anjali has started to feel worthwhile here is that she got a job making popcorn. Then nobody's paying her. Nobody says she has to do it.
Right.
But now she's part of the community. And I think you're right.
Yeah.
That there isn't enough that makes a child or a young adolescent or even a 12, 13-year-old feel that there's something they had to do. If you have large families, as they used to do, you have to take care of some of the kids.
Or farming.
Yeah.
Started doing
something. And
picking strawberries.
So much is automated, brought in.
Yeah.
I find the more responsibility I give her and expect it, the more she does. So if I go to work and say, "Anjali, I'm having a really long day today. I don't think I feel like cooking dinner. So when I get home, I want to find the house looking okay and a meal cooked."
Yeah.
She responds beautifully. But if I stand there and say, "I think you should cook the meal now. I want you to cook X, Y, and Z,"
She'll have to do it. But if I hand over a big responsibility for her to make choices, the bigger the responsibility, the better she does it.
Mm-hmm. That's home work. And I think that's important. And my daughter will respond like that too. Make dinner is better than chop this up in most situations. But she's 18 now, so it depends on the age. Mm-hmm. But I still think that this outside of the work, outside of the home work opportunities, where you do get paid, because there's a certain...
it's responsibility to labor, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is. And you have a different sense of... what it's like to buy something with the money that you earned, as opposed to making a choice to buy something with money that's been given to you. Mm-hmm. It's a different thing.
How much time it takes to get the money.
Yeah. And we want her, on the one hand, we say, you know, we want you to be able to contribute towards college. And on the other hand, she's doing this volunteer work, which is important. I don't know. I have a concern
they used to
in that area.
Factory jobs too, didn't they? Instead of, and eventually you could go somewhere, you know, but that have disappeared now because of automation and.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, and I think that's a societal thing too that really concerns me. That there were, I'm concerned that you're really going to have to be intellectually top of the heap to have any kind of employment down the road. Because the more mundane occupations have kind of, they're evaporating.
Like, they're so poorly paid.
Yeah.
So poorly paid. I mean, this working poor problem is a terrible problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
But, and the volunteer thing is, it is complex, I think, too, that yesterday we were talking about the service projects, if you do them with the adults. Mm-hmm. Like a caring pastor or the parents.
Yeah.
It's not just, hey, you kids, you go out and clean up this, or you go visit the awful. It's we are doing this, and we're going to reflect on this somehow a little bit too. That is powerful. Mm-hmm. That is powerful. And then they see meaningful work. We built the Habitat for Humanity, and we were doing that for kids. I mean, they see it is powerful.
Done
I
some
have
of that.
Built something loved it. Here, you know? And if you do it in a way with adults, caring adults, they see you embodying this caring, and then they are more apt to embody it. Mm. And then to reflect a little bit on it somehow, just in some kind of conversation, they say is tremendously important.
Yeah.
That's something worthwhile. They see they contribute.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of ways to do worthwhile work that's not for pay.
Yeah.
But then there also
you,
need
you
to
also need to, and production. That's not even it because the without a, that's our society that we don't pay for some things
and we overpay for
and others. We do pay for others.
Oh, you mean the basketball stars? Nah. Have you seen that?
No.
40 essential things that every child needs to...
Yes.
Have you seen that?
Yeah, that's nice.
No,
yeah.
What's that?
I don't have that.
40 essential things that... like... Pardon me?
The asset.
Those assets, 40 assets.
Maybe it's assets.
That's the Search Institute. And it's nice. It's a little...
Truth in... Yeah.
It kind of shows what kids need from the parents, the community, the school, how you kind of have...
Oh.
It is neat when... Somebody besides the parents reinforces what you're saying as parents. You know, that's why it's nice. You get a great pastor, you get a good teacher, somebody else. They see these mentors. Mm-hmm. Our church did a nice thing with mentoring young people during confirmation.
I have to go look for my kid.
Well, we need to go to so much.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your conversation.
Thank you.
I just got here yesterday.
Yeah.
Are you going to take this to Karen?
Yeah.